This week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible with support from Linksys. Bad Wi-Fi is usually due to your Wi-Fi equipment rather than the ISP. Update to Linksys and kiss dead zones goodbye. Linksys solves the biggest Wi-Fi issues like buffering and connection problems and can easily set up guest access and parental controls. Visit Linksys.com to save 15% off a new router with the code UNTITLED while supplies last. Cannot be combined with other promos. Refurbished products not eligible for this promotion. One per customer. Now on with the show. Hey everybody, Norm here. I wanted to give you a heads up that we actually were unable to record a new episode of Still Entitled this week, but Adam was able to join us for a new episode of Offworld. So that's what you're going to get this week. Offworld, if you haven't listened to it before, is one of our other podcasts. It stars Ariel Waldman, and she and special guests deconstruct and break down some of their favorite science fiction and space movies. In this episode, Ariel, Adam, and special guest Ryan Nagata talk about one of their favorite space movies, Apollo 13. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Still Entitled.
So today we're talking about Apollo 13, film made in 1995, or film that came out in 1995. I totally love it. Today on the show, we have Adam Savage. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Ryan, can you please introduce yourself and a bit about what you do? I just met you in person. I know some people at Tested here know what you do, but please tell us more.
Yeah. Well, I make really high fidelity replicas of spacesuits. And I do them for museum exhibits, I do them for private collectors, and occasionally I do them for movies. I made the X-15 pressure suit that Ryan Gosling is wearing in First Man, which I did another Tested video about. And I never thought I would be able to do that for a living, but enough people and organizations want replica spacesuits that I keep making them.
Yeah, well, and you and I were just talking about how we both sort of come from an art background and sort of stumbled into NASA and space stuff, which is fun.
Yeah. Well, I really like hearing stories about that sort of thing. I'm actually a member of an organization called IAAA that is the International Association of Astronomical Artists.
Really?
Yeah. That's pretty badass.
I didn't know that was such a thing.
Yeah. Well, it's apparently it has some connections to Carl Sagan. So early in the early days of NASA, I think NASA recognized that it was important to commission space artwork. So I think that's, you might have seen that Norman Rockwell painting mm-hmm. of Gus Grissom and John Young. I think that was a part of that program. Paul Kelly's painting of Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon that was part of the postage stamp, that was part of that program.
And there's actually a bunch of those, there's a bunch of that kind of artwork at the Far Out exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art
right.
about space habitats, and it's about NASA's prognostication using artists and visualizers as to what it might look like.
Yeah, but they, I guess they stopped that program probably at the end of Apollo, and Carl Sagan, found a lot of these artists to work on his projects, like Cosmos. I think there's a lot of the art in there. I think he also recognized the need for space art. And so they started that organization years ago. It's like a guild of space artists. I don't do a lot with them, but I contribute to the organization just because I think it's important.
No, that's awesome.
Well, one of the things I love about the obsessiveness of your work, Ryan, is that I was in D.C. a couple weeks ago talking to Lisa Young, the conservator who restored Neil Armstrong's suit. And there's a lot of institutional knowledge that gets lost just because people matriculate out of NASA. And then a lot of that data is reclaimed by obsessives like Ryan and me and you, who start to zone in on something specific we're passionate about and turn out to be the repository of that institutional knowledge. I really, really love that. Lisa was saying how much they rely on collectors and enthusiasts to figure out what this part was and how that worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know, we're talking a bit about astronauts today and the movie Apollo 13. And I wanted to ask both of you, you know, what impact the movie had on you in the 90s when you saw it?
That's kind of why I'm here. And that's why I have reached out to you specifically about this movie, because as a kid, I was into the space shuttle. That's what was happening in the 80s. And I really didn't know anything about Apollo. I knew that we had gone to the moon because I had seen the picture of Buzz Aldrin, that man on the moon photo. But I didn't know how we got there. I didn't know anything about the program. So when I saw the movie Apollo 13, it blew my mind. Like everything about it, the suits they were wearing obviously was a big thing with those clear bubbles. The Saturn V rocket, I had seen a Saturn V before, but I didn't realize that there were actually people on the very tip right. of that rocket.
But it was crude, yeah.
It is a thing the first time you engage with how tiny the payload is at the top of...
Yeah, right. You think they've got the whole rocket to just, like, swim around in.
Yeah. Which they did on Skylab, actually. That they just converted a third stage.
Seeing Skylab at the Smithsonian, I was amazed how much bigger it was than I was prepared
yeah.
for.
Yeah.
That's they'll never have a station like that again. It was just a huge empty space in space. But
I love watching them run around.
But anyway, it was that movie that introduced me to Apollo. And I made my first spacesuit replica ever was after I saw that movie because I really wanted one of the suits in that movie, which maybe we'll do another video on sometime with that suit because I still have it.
What did you make the suit out? Like you said you were pretty young when you made this
yeah,
suit.
Yeah, I was 14. So I made it out of like painter's coveralls, like extra large painter's coveralls that I cut up and re-glued back together. I think the disconnects were like the tops of soda cans. I remember the big thing was the bubble helmet. There was a plastic store near me, and I had my mom take me there, and I bought two acrylic domes and glued them together. But it was crazy. That was 25 years ago now, and I never thought that I would be doing that for a living because I did a lot of other things in between then and now, but maybe about 5 years ago, I realized I could make a much better suit replica now, and I still had the passion for it. So I did, and I mean, that's all I've been doing ever since. But that's a good example of a movie or a piece of art inspiring somebody to do something sort of in the real space program, because I do, you know, work a lot with museums and that sort
yeah,
of thing as well.
Absolutely. Adam, what impact did it have on you in the 90s?
The key, so I was older than you when I saw it. Mm-hmm. I was in my mid-20s. And I mean, aside from being just a phenomenal movie, there are so many aspects I now see that are just wonderfully different than a normal narrative would do. The whole narrative of Gary Sinise troubleshooting how to the correct sequence of switches to maintain the right amount of power with the limits that they had. That scientific approach of using the control at home to, you know, and this is JPL's entire model, right? It's NASA's model, and it's a brilliant one, and it gets to be such a significant plot point. So from an engineering standpoint, I really resonated with that. But of course, the moment that hit me the most was, you got to make an oxygen scrubber, and this is all that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that problem solving, I'll spend my whole life hoping to be in that room at some other time to help solve that kind of problem.
The ultimate hackathon.
The ultimate hackathon, the ultimate in situ resource utilization. I loved that then once they solved the problem, it required a set of protocols, which was a list of things. And having built many lists of complicated sets of operations for my crew on Mythbusters and Untested and other ventures, it's non-trivial. And they had like minutes, yeah. not hours or mm-hmm. days. And then even I just remember reading, like he's reading like line item 2, tear a piece of tape approximately 36 inches in yeah. length. And you're like, yep, that's exactly how you do that. And again, they sort of showed behind the curtain. They made the engineering and they showed you that everyone was an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made that engineering such a part of the plot, it made me feel warmly embraced by the whole film.
Yeah. Ryan, what did you think was particularly illuminating about the film to you?
Well, everything. Obviously, that suiting up scene was big. I don't think I knew how they put on a spacesuit. Like I said, I didn't know that they had these clear bubble helmets. I like that whole launch sequence. I think it has a healthy dose of romanticism in it. I worked on First Man, and I really enjoyed that film, but one of the things that it definitely doesn't have is that romantic aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you need a little bit of that. I think it inspires people. And so that launch sequence always gets me. I always tear up. I liked how the narrative of the film is based on these real life engineering problems that they had. I also like that I saw The Martian, and it's there's obviously some similarities with that. But unlike The Martians, based on a real story, so each of these guys, they're not even named in Apollo 13, but if you look them up, they're all mm-hmm. like real people. Like the guy who Gary Sinise is working with to find that sequence mm-hmm. of, is this engineer, John Aaron, who was a real guy. And you can kind of just look on Wikipedia for the things he did. He was the guy who... during Apollo 12, when it was struck by lightning during the launch, there's he said to Alan Bean that he should try switching from SCE to AUX, and nobody in the room had any idea what he was talking about. And apparently, this blows my mind too, is that there were switches on the command module that. That most people didn't even know were even there. That's how complex the spacecraft was. And the only reason he knew, he happened to be in the chair at the time when Apollo 12 was being launched. And he, like a year earlier, was at the Kennedy Space Center, and he had noticed this odd telemetry pattern that would happen when the electronics were going wrong. And he figured out on his own that flipping the SCE to auxiliary switch fix the problem. And really
probably
nobody
by
else,
thinking through the wiring diagram.
Yeah,
in his head.
I mean, it was just really on his own initiative. And so when Apollo 12 was happening and he saw the telemetry was having the same thing, he said, why don't you try that? And in the capsule, only Alan Bean knew what that was. Like the other two guys were like, what's SCE to AUX? And he's like, I think I know what that switch is. And he switched it and it saved the mission.
Wow.
So that's like... that was John Aaron, and he was one of the ECOM on Apollo 13 mm-hmm. at that time. So was Cy Liebergott. But I like that you can watch that movie and sort of do your own research and see that all of these people are based on real guys, and they have history that extends beyond the movie. Mm-hmm. It's like I don't know, like Game of Thrones or something, where you can go on like. And find that there's
as
a backstory.
Yeah.
Well, except it's real.
And I think one of the things that was interesting about it, and I'd be curious if it was sort of the first film to really illuminate, was Mission Control. Because, mm-hmm. you know, so much about going into space is it's all about the astronauts, all about, you know, everyone who's going into space. And, yeah, there's some people on the ground that sort of help them. Da, da, da. But, you know, Apollo 13 really is like Mission Control is just incredible, and you get to see Gene Kranz, like, mm-hmm. you know, depicted. Yeah, I love Gene Kranz. Huge Gene Kranz fan. Hope to meet him someday. But it's just, I think it did a good job of really showing, you know, maybe not the thousands of people involved mm-hmm. in the program, but at least how important Mission Control was and how they were heroes in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that when you look at the canon of great space films, like from Wright Stuff to Apollo 13, First Man, Hidden Figures, and others, each one is looking at a different population mm-hmm. that is part of the grand thing. And I mean, Wright Stuff is very super romantic, mm-hmm. hyper romantic. I mean, it's about American culture as mm-hmm. much as it's about the Mercury 7. Mm-hmm. And I love that Apollo 13 seems to be about the astronauts at first, mm-hmm. but it's doing as jumping off point that Apollo's a mature program. Mm-hmm. This is mm-hmm. something that they do. And then it all goes to hell. And then, yeah, we feature the engineering of what it's like to manage that. And even down to when you hear back from Apollo 13 after the 4 minutes of silence while they're coming mm-hmm. through the atmosphere, and everyone erupts into applause, but Kranz stays kind of, and the real footage of the event, Kranz is also exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Ed Harris is a perfect guy to play him.
Yeah,
I met Gene Kranz at Johnson a couple years ago
oh,
when
nice.
I was there, and I was talking about the vests.
Yeah.
And he said that before they realized the vests were super valuable, that they gave a bunch away to the Goodwill.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, why would you know?
I think some are in the Smithsonian now.
I know. Yeah. And some of them are probably sitting in someone's closet down in Texas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so speaking of the fashion in Apollo 13, since both of you are spacesuit aficionados, to say the least, what is your favorite spacesuit scene in the movie? Like, is there one... like,
oh, interesting
angle or click of the, you know, the gloves going on? Or is there something where you're just like, oh, I really love that part of the spacesuit that they showed?
Yeah, I like the whole sequence, but the things that were of particular interest to me, I remember, was the scene where the suit is being zipped up. Because I think when I first saw that, I thought, I didn't realize that a spacesuit had a zipper on the back, and how would you be able to pressurize a suit with a zipper? But then when I, you know, got into the research a little bit more, I realized that those suits really did have pressure sealing zippers, like you would have on a scuba dry suit or something. They don't do that anymore. It was not the best system for suits.
No, the Russians elided the zippers entirely.
Mm-hmm. But, and then, of course, all the disconnects. They show close-ups of the gloves and all of that working.
It's all Chris Gilman's work from Global Effects. Am I right?
Apollo 13 was the Cosmosphere.
Oh.
So yeah, Global Effects did From the Earth to the Moon, which was sort of right after. But yeah, all of the hardware in that movie was done by the Kansas Cosmosphere. Oh. They have a Spaceworks division, and they don't make suits anymore.
They only do spacecraft.
It was a brief period of time where they made spacesuit replicas, and they did the ones in that movie.
They're really good-looking replicas.
Yeah. Well, they had, I don't know how many suits in their collection there, and they used those as a reference.
That's I still need to visit the Kansas Cosmosphere. Yeah, I grew up in Kansas, and then I learned about it after I moved away. I was like, ah!
Damn it, I'm not a Kansas
yeah. I've wanted to go there, but it's sort of, I'm told, kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Like, it's not near Kansas City where I was around.
I also really, when I think about the costumes from the film, I love the normal suits they're wearing in the LEM while they're on their way back. Mm-hmm. Like all those shots of them sort of goofing around and eating food and getting tired and cranky. A couple of years ago, Ryan connected me up with a seller, and I purchased a pair of beta cloth astronaut pants.
Yeah.
Similar to what they might have worn on there. Right? These are not flown, but the astronauts did wear it. Like,
yeah. Well, that was called the in-flight coverall garment. So...
the ICG.
Starting with, the ICG.
The IFCG.
Everything, up until Apollo, they had always worn their pressure suits in the capsules because they were not super long duration missions, except for Gemini 7 they designed those special suits for Borman and Lovell to wear because they knew they would be wearing them for like 2 weeks. But they realized they needed something else for the astronauts to wear. They couldn't wear the spacesuit for 2 weeks or whatever. And so they created those in-flight coverall garments, and they were made of Teflon. So the ones you have were beta cloth because the first ones they did were beta cloth, which is Teflon-coated silica fiber. But it was too uncomfortable to wear that, from what I'm told.
Do you think, I didn't wear them for long. I did put them on enough to know that they fit me.
Yeah.
But was it that they got hot? Was it?
You know, I've read different things, and I don't always trust the information I read. I always have to cross-reference it with other things. But some things I read were that they got like fiberglass dermatitis from the fiberglass. Hey. But the purpose of – I'm not sure I believe that, because the purpose of the beta cloth was that they coated the fibers with Teflon so that wouldn't happen. But for whatever reason, they just said beta cloth was not good for those. So they just used straight Teflon fabric.
You bring up something. When I was in D.C., I hosted the Kennedy Center 50th celebration, and one of the guests on there was Charles Fishman, who wrote One Giant Leap, which is a delightful and wonderful book, which I don't know if you've read. But
I haven't.
I'm in the green room with Charles for the whole performance. He had a lot of time to ask me questions about your spacesuit hanging in the corner because I wore it during the production. And as I was telling him stories about it, he said, oh, after like an hour, he goes, I get it. I get it. You know what you are? And I was like, what? And he's like, you're a journalist.
Interesting.
Like, yeah. Part of this exploration that you're doing, you could call it journalism. And when you say, I don't trust everything I read, I cross-check it. There is a journalistic aspect to way in which we gather the information and what's important to us.
Yeah.
And I loved that frame of considering it.
Yeah, it's totally a research. I mean, if you're not heavy in research, then, you know, what's the point kind of? Yeah. I mean, another interesting aspect of Apollo 13 that I wanted to ask you about was the special effects. So it's, you know, the film came out in 95. My understanding is it used entirely models and then sort of augmented the models with some computer graphics. And I also read that the Saturn V that they built was like an 18-foot model of Saturn V. And then they like added, so when you see like the Saturn V taking off, you're seeing a model with some computer graphics of, I guess, the steam and everything around it. What are your thoughts, Adam, on like the special effects for?
They're stunning. I mean,
they hold up, don't
they?
Really
do. In fact, I believe they used some of those for another film. There's another, it might even be from the Earth to the Moon that they reused some of the Apollo 13 shots.
Yeah, probably. It was the same production company.
Yeah. They're still stunning effects. And then, of course, they did so much of the zero gravity shooting using a set they built into NASA's Vomit Comet, which, having ridden in the zero G plane.
I was going to ask if both of you have done Vomit Comet.
I have done it.
Yeah, I've done it before. Actually, I did it the day after you did.
Oh, really?
The Mythbusters episode. Because the day I did it, they said the Mythbusters were here yesterday. This is before I knew you.
That's so funny.
That was years ago.
we weren't allowed. They allowed us to film there. They didn't charge us, which is a significant savings because it's expensive.
Yeah.
But the requirement of us filming is that we weren't allowed to use the word vomit or talk about throwing up at all.
Really?
I did throw up. After I was done filming, I did throw up. And apparently, according to Tom Hanks, I talked to him about this, the whole crew was booting on that. It was rough. I mean, doing those parabolas, especially when you're doing them for days on end.
Oh, days of it, I would totally.
It's everyone. They just, you'd come back wrecked from the repeated nausea. And yet, the footage is unassailably magnificent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing about that movie is as time goes by, effects and technology get better. They can duplicate things to a higher degree of fidelity. Like with First Man, I think there's even some improvement in the image quality. But the advantage of Apollo 13 was that it was 25 years after the event. So they used a lot of real hardware in that movie before it was, like the flashlights they were using were they were still using those on the shuttles.
So
they had those.
Oh, yeah.
And they were able to use the Vomit Comet. And I just don't think there will ever be a movie that does that again. So in a way, it's this historical document in some sense of you know, what it looked like to be in zero G and what all that hardware looked like.
And the zero G thing is, I mean, directors from the history of film have always worked in different ways. Stanley Kubrick, of course, like in multiple sets of shots is using like five different hanging rigs for five different shots in sequence. So your brain is never quite figuring out the magic trick. And yet nothing equates to Bill Paxton throwing a pen across the cabin. Yeah. Like there is no special effect that can render something that your brain just knows is real. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it puts you in that capsule.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was watching it, actually, I didn't look up any notes on the special effects or anything until after the fact. And I was watching, I was like, that has to be a zero G plane because there's also like, if you've watched enough zero G plane footage, it's like it's microgravity, but it's sort of like sort of limp microgravity. Mm-hmm. So you sort of see people flowing, sending a pen across, but it's sort of got like a slight arc to it. Just little things that like I can pick up on because I've watched enough of the zero G plane footage. I haven't actually been on one of those planes and I don't know.
We've got to get you on one of those.
I would need a little convincing because I've had sort of the principle of like, if I'm going to vomit, I better be in space. Like, if I'm going to go through.
I will tell you that the zero G plane and an F-18 Hornet are both experiences in which vomiting did not detract from my enjoyment even one bit.
Good to know.
Like, I would do both of those again on any day of the week at any time at the drop of a hat.
Good to know. I've learned vomiting does get in the way of my enjoyment of some things. So
gets in the way of my enjoyment of almost everything else. But the F-18 was like, this is the price of admission. Blah, that's pocket. Blah, here we go. Actually, on the zero-G plane, there's a moment in which I throw up into the bag and I look down and I realize, oh, there's nothing holding this in the bag, so I better close it physically.
Yeah, that's perhaps the most important thing. And yeah, you see people vomiting in Apollo 13. Well, you see the one guy vomiting in Apollo 13, and you're just like, oh,
yeah. I think that was real, too. It was Bill Paxton.
That was real vomit?
So the thing about having been on countless movie sets and commercial sets and Mythbuster sets in which discomfort was part of the job that day, I read a lot of behind this, like you read the interviews with the actors and Ron Howard about shooting on that zero G plane, how many days they were doing it. And the Cinefex covers it at some depth. And what you read between the lines is that it was miserable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things of like, you can talk about it and you're glad you did it and the footage is unassailably great. Mm-hmm. But holy hell, like after days and days and days, no one was anything but broken by that. Like it's brutal.
Yeah. So, okay. So my final question is, what space history moment deserves essentially the Apollo 13 treatment in so much as what space history moment hasn't had a movie made about it that deserves something like an Apollo 13 movie? I guess I'll start while you both think. For me, I don't know, there's a lot to pick from, but I would maybe choose Voyager and like the making of the Golden Record and like fighting with NASA about what goes on the Golden Record or what they're allowed to do or not, or even the Pioneer plaque for that matter.
You know, I don't know if I have a good answer for that, because the longest time I had wished they made an Apollo 11 movie, and now they eventually did.
It's so magnificent.
Although that movie was more about Neil Armstrong, it wasn't as much about
you're talking about First Man.
Yeah.
Because I love the new Apollo 11
which of course is documentary with some nice elements to it.
But yeah, I had always wanted to see an actual lunar landing. Covered cinematically and they fortunately
and you got
did
your
that.
Wish.
Yeah, they did that. So
I have always been super compelled by that shot of Ed White on the very first extravehicular spacewalk. For some reason, I find that shot of him at the end of the umbilical holding that little rocket camera so compelling and so lonely and intense. From an engineering standpoint, the idea that he's the first one to exit the cabin
scary
from where he is, I find it never, it's never not terrifying to me. And so that photo, just getting chills even describing it, that photo to me is an amazing moment, and the triumph of engineering and his trust in the engineering at that moment in time. Because that suit was not meant for EVAs.
Yeah.
It's the last time we'd send a suit like that out there, unless it was a terrible emergency.
I did think of something, though, because you talked about Ed White, and then I thought about Alexei Leonov, who did the first spacewalk. But I thought, we haven't really seen a lot of movies about the Russian space program.
Yeah.
And I know there are some, I think there's one that came out, but it's a Russian film, and it didn't get a wide release here. I don't even know if you can see it here, about that first Russian spacewalk. But I would like to see some.
I'd love
some
to see one about Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space, because supposedly her family didn't even know she was going. She couldn't tell her family she was going into space, and they heard about it on the radio, supposedly.
Wow.
Like, she was like, oh, yeah, I'm just doing something. And it's like they learned she's like, that would be amazing as a movie.
They must have had a moment of disconnect where they're like, well, there must be someone else with that name.
Maybe. Who knows? Who knows? Well, thank you so much. For being on the show today.
Thanks for having us. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. We're talking about Apollo 13. Of course we're coming.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Once again, that was Ariel, Adam, and our friend Ryan Nagata in an episode of Offworld, one of the many podcasts that we do on Tested. If you enjoy that episode, I encourage you to subscribe. You can find Offworld on iTunes as well as other podcast providers. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Still Untitled. See you then.